Information at WholeFoodsMarket.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With the Iowa caucus now less than 2 weeks away, we are in the home stretch of our series of profiles of the Democratic primary candidates. We've spoken with all of them so far, with just two exceptions. One is our guest tonight, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. The widely presumed early front runner in the campaign now faces an uphill battle to win his party's nomination. But John Kerry has been in tough battles before. A new poll shows him tied for second with Wesley Clark in a survey of New Hampshire voters. Strong front-runner there, Howard Dean, is the man to beat. But sometimes it seems as though John Kerry is running against his own patrician demeanor, a decorated Vietnam vet grown too nuanced for the campaign brawl. Not so, he says. That's experience and insight talking, the kind it takes to win. Tonight on Point, crunch time for John Kerry in the Democratic primaries. I spoke with John Kerry earlier as he took some time out from pressing the flesh in Iowa. Senator John Kerry, good evening and welcome to On Point.
I'm glad to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So where are you right now? What do you see outside the car window, Senator Kerry?
I see these extraordinary fields that are about to open up as I leave Des Moines, and I'm heading to Cedar Rapids, and I'm campaigning hard in Iowa for a couple of days, be in New Hampshire tomorrow, and we're just working.
Extraordinary fields has to mean Iowa. John Kerry, let me just go straight to it with you. What is it going to take to beat George Bush next November, and have you got it, and does Howard Dean have it?
Well, I believe it's going to take somebody with national security experience and with international security affairs, foreign affairs, military affairs experience. I just don't believe we're going to have the ability to get to the subject of health care, education, the economy, the environment, if George Bush is intent on making national security the central issue of the campaign. And I think I bring to this race the breadth of experience on the domestic issues, 35 years of fighting for these things, but also the experience we need to stand up to George Bush and make it clear that we Democrats know how to make America safer and stronger in the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and John Kennedy and Bill Clinton. We can do that. I think, regrettably, I respect Howard Dean's efforts with respect to the grassroots organizing and things he's done, but I think that the lack of foreign policy experience, the lack of security experience in this particular election cycle is going to be a critical issue.
We'll talk more about that, but let me put this to you first. Describe for us, paint a picture. What does a John Kerry presidency look like compared to George Bush's?
My presidency will be proactive and humble and engaged with the world. It'll be a presidency that makes the workplace in America fair. I have never seen the American workplace as distorted by crony capitalism and crony government as it is under George Bush. The Medicare bill is a classic example of lobbyists turning a Medicare benefit for seniors into a benefit for drug companies. The energy bill is a classic example of oil and gas industry distorting our needs for alternative and renewable and clean energy in the country. And they've added $18 billion to the deficit even as they do it. In all the years I've been in public life, I have never seen such an incredible giveaway to the powerful moneyed interests that lobby Washington at the expense of the average American. Even today, they've announced that the Labor Department's putting out a pamphlet showing people or information showing people how they can avoid paying workers overtime so that they're attacking even the 40-hour work week. I think my presidency will complete the mission of Harry Truman. I will make health care a matter of right, not privilege in America. I'm going to put in place a 5-year ban on any government official going into lobbying. They just can't do it for 5 years. I'm going to require every meeting of lobbyists and public officials to be a matter of official public record. I'm going to fully fund No Child Left Behind, and I'm going to change No Child Left Behind.
And yet, John Kerry, you know that despite the holes that you would be blowing in George Bush's record here, he's fairly popular. He's seen in many quarters as the front runner heading toward next fall's election. To what do you attribute the president's popularity?
It's very easy to understand. First of all, he's the president of the United States, and there's no single candidate that's running against him. Secondly, we are at war, and there's a natural instinct for America to unify behind their president when we're at war, and I respect that. But next year, when you have a nominee, and it's really face-to-face, toe-to-toe, people need to stop and think about what kind of America they want. And then it's up to me, as the Democratic nominee, to articulate to our country a vision that obviously connects to people, that taps into the hopes and aspirations of our country. I think I can do that. I know people are just groaning under the cost of health care in America. We can lower the cost of health care. I know people are desperate about the quality of education for their kids. We can provide the resources and the accountability. People are sick about what's happened to our reputation and influence around the world. I will lead us back to the table on global warming, back to the table of the United Nations. I will negotiate with North Korea. I'll advance the cause of peace in the Middle East. And I won't hesitate to put proliferation at the top of the international agenda and buy up the loose nuclear material in Russia.
John Kerry, let me ask you, you've got a ton of experience behind you on many fronts. You came into this campaign early on as a presumed front runner. You're now in many polls lagging. What have you learned on this long campaign trail?
You know, I think the presumption of front runner was exactly that, a presumption. But I'm coming on strong in Iowa right now. My campaign is growing. And I think people are really now finally listening and looking. For a long period of time, with the divisions over the war, there was just a polarization, and it was very difficult to communicate. I think now people are really looking for who's got the experience to be able to lead America in a very complicated world.
On that front, let me ask you, is your vote for authorizing the war in Iraq still hurting you with Democratic primary voters?
No, and the reason it's not is that people are coming to understand that that was a vote to hold Saddam Hussein accountable through the United Nations, under the rule of law, with other nations, and only going to war as a last resort. That was the promise the president made. And the president broke every single one of those promises. And what people are beginning to understand, Tom, is they look at the wholeness, you know, the totality of my record. I came back and led efforts to end the war in Vietnam. I stood up and took risks. I stood up and took risks to stop the war that Ronald Reagan was running illegally in Central America. I blew the whistle on Oliver North and his private aid network. I've stood up against Star Wars.
But did you just feel politically in the fall of 2002 that you could not vote against war with Iraq, that the 9/11 steamroller was still so heavy?
It had nothing to do with politics. It had everything to do with the security of the United States and the appropriate way for the United States and the president to hold Saddam Hussein accountable. We could not have gotten the troops, the inspectors, back into Iraq without the vote and a legitimate threat of force. And we had a right to expect that the President of the United States would use it properly. And I just say this to you, Tom. People who know me know that if I had been President of the United States of America, I would not have taken us to war the way George Bush did.
Senator Kerry, that may be your view, but a lot of Democrats apparently in the polls have been attracted to Howard Dean's sharp criticism of the war. You've been pretty sharp with him in just the last couple of days. You've called Howard Dean's policy on Iraq duplicitous. What do you mean by that?
I mean that Howard Dean actually announced more than one policy. On October 6th, 5 days before we voted in the United States Senate, Howard Dean announced publicly that he felt Saddam Hussein was a threat, that he needed to be disarmed, and he supported publicly the Biden-Lugar resolution that gave authority to the president to go to war. So he, in fact, made the same judgment as everybody else. And then several months later, when it was convenient, he started to criticize those people who made the same judgment he made, only because he didn't have to vote at all and was free to take that position.
You're saying he made the same turnaround that you made?
He made the same, that wasn't a turnaround. I laid this out very clearly in my speech on the floor of the Senate. I said I renounced the doctrine of preemption. I said that I am only voting for the president to go through the United Nations process, which he promised he would. And if he goes around it, if he doesn't go to war because of the weapons of mass destruction, ultimately as an inspection mechanism, I will oppose him. I never changed. It was one consistent view. and it's been consistent all along.
Looking at the poll numbers right now, Dr. Dean is leading pretty handily on any number of fronts, including in New Hampshire, neighboring state to your own, Massachusetts. You have said that Dean will lose, or suggested that he'll lose, and he'll take a lot of Democratic politicians down with him. It's been pretty tough language. What's the basis for you saying that, and are you giving ammunition to the GOP in these attacks on Howard Dean?
I think I'm stating the reality which a lot of people in our party are concerned about, that if you're going to run against a wartime president, and if you're going to run against a president who has announced that he intends to make national security the principal issue of the campaign, you need to have a nominee of your party who has the ability to stand up to him on that issue. I believe that George Bush has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the lack of experience in the White House is a critical issue. I think he's proven that it's not the place for on-the-job training. And I think that, look, you're hiring somebody who's not just president of the United States. You're hiring the leader of the free world. You know, I just don't think it's appropriate to suggest that we're going to have an easy time when someone comes in with statements like the capture of Saddam Hussein doesn't make America safer. Of course we're safer. This is a man who was loose out in Iraq, who had the potential to come back with the Ba'athists, who was a troublemaker.
Presumably he won't now. John Kerry, every candidate has to deal with characterizations. President Bush got characterized as a Texas Yahoo. Howard Dean gets characterized as a collar-ripping, angry man. You have been characterized, in Joe Klein's words, as preposterously dignified. Have you found a block to your connecting with American voters in your demeanor, your regionalness, the persona that you present?
Absolutely not at all. And if you were out here in Iowa listening to the crowds that have been at my events, 300 and 400 people on a snowy night, 500 people in Cedar Rapids the other day at a school on a Saturday night, and they're stomping and they're cheering and they're excited.
We hear that and we read it, but then why is this feisty blue blood from Vermont, if the polls are right, selling hotter than a senatorial blue blood from neighboring Massachusetts?
There are a lot of reasons for it. That's not what's important right now. What's important right now is that I'm campaigning for every vote, that I'm a fighter, that I bring the experience necessary to beat George Bush. And in the last poll in New Hampshire, even though I ran behind Howard Dean in the Democratic primary, I ran ahead of Howard Dean head-to-head against George Bush in New Hampshire.
John Kerry, we've got
people need to decide. Are we going to have somebody that we nominate, or are we going to have somebody who can win the presidency?
We've got 1 minute left. I want to give you some issues for a quick response on where you stand. NAFTA, 10 years on, are you glad you voted for it?
It was the right vote at the time, absolutely, but the side agreements were not enforced, and today we need to have labor standards and environment standards as part of our trade agreements in the trade agreement itself.
Cities in your state are looking to import drugs from Canada. Are you for that or not?
For that, absolutely. Yes, we should be able to do that.
Gay marriage.
I am personally opposed, but I am for enforcing equal protection under the law, and I think we have to enforce the orders of the court to provide full rights to people.
And if Iraq drags on, Senator John Kerry, can you imagine the United States ever needing to institute a draft again?
No, I think that with the proper leadership in our country, we can go back to the United Nations, we can bring NATO in, we can give legitimacy to a new government. We have to get Halliburton and Paul Bremer and this provisional game out of there, transfer the authority for reconstruction and for the government transformation to an international body, and give it legitimacy. I'm convinced, I've talked to Kofi Annan, I've talked to other people, we can make that happen, but we need a president who understands how to do it and who's prepared to do it.
And Senator Kerry, last question, paint the picture. We've got the primaries coming up on us very quickly now. What's the path that John Kerry can follow? What wins or near wins do you need to come out as the Democratic nominee?
Well, I'm going to surprise people in Iowa. I'm going to do very well here, and I think people are suddenly going to recognize that a lot of things people have been writing are not on target, that we're doing very well as a campaign, we're moving forward, that my message is connecting to people.
And New Hampshire, do you have to win there to go on?
No, I don't have to, but obviously I want to do as well as I can. I'm going to do as well as I can. I intend to win there, and I think people are feeling the energy and commitment of the campaign, and most importantly, they're beginning to see that the specific programs I've laid out. For instance, Howard Dean's going to raise taxes on the middle class. I'm not. I'm going to balance the budget by cutting the deficit in half in 4 years. But I'm not going to do it by getting rid of the child tax credit, getting rid of the 10% bracket, and raising taxes on the middle class.
And we hear
People are now learning. People are learning those differences, Tom, and that makes a difference.
And we hear it from you, Senator John Kerry, on the road to Cedar Rapids. Thank you very much for joining
Thanks
us tonight.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
John Kerry speaking with me from the campaign trail in Iowa just a couple of hours ago. You can join our conversation tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with and about Senator John Kerry and his long, hard march on the White House. You can join our conversation tonight. When you see John Kerry at the podium in the Democratic debates, what do you see? He was a Vietnam War hero and an anti-war hero. How do you read the complexities of John Kerry? Could the senator from Massachusetts still pull it out? How? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a great crew to look at John Kerry with us tonight. Joining me in the studio tonight is Joan Vinaki. She's columnist for the Boston Globe. She's written penetratingly on the Kerry campaign. Joan, it's great to have you here. Good evening and welcome.
Nice to be here, Tom.
And joining us from Des Moines, Iowa is Walter Shapiro, political columnist for USA Today and author of the new book, One Car Caravan, On the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In. Walter Shapiro, great to have you with us from Des Moines tonight.
Oh, it's always fun.
Wonderful to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Walter Shapiro, we're going to turn to you first in Des Moines. You just heard John Kerry speaking with us from there. He was on his bus headed for Cedar Rapids. He says he's got a hot thing going on. How is he doing in Iowa?
Well, the first thing about Iowa is a state where polls are almost impossible to measure because no one knows for sure who's coming to the caucuses.
Right.
That said, there is a sense that even when John Kerry was being dismissed by the insiders because he was faltering in New Hampshire, that folks in Iowa somehow curiously never got the message. So in that sense, Kerry probably is running a strong third right now in Iowa, but it's really more impressionistic than data-driven.
Is a strong third good enough for the Massachusetts senator in Iowa, Walter Shapiro?
It may well be. I mean, we have no idea how this is going to be perceived, whether four candidates are bunched. Obviously, if Howard Dean just runs away with the Iowa caucuses, which I think is possible but unlikely, it's, of course, great for Dean and bad for any of Dean's challengers. But if Kerry is close to the pace, close to Gephardt, he could even sneak into second place. They're talking about a bounce for New Hampshire. I don't know how big a bounce because the Iowa caucuses a day later is the State of the Union message, and we have no idea if that will still resonate, but there is still an annoying synthetic quality to the Kerry campaign. Yesterday, I saw him give a speech to a women's group with his new slogan behind him, a fighter with results. Al Gore and Al Gore's handlers in 2000 liked to use fight in every single sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Karen Hughes who described George Bush, of all people, before the South Carolina primary as a reformer with results. So as synthetic things go, the phrase a fighter with results is sort of political Mad Libs.
Not working necessarily for John Kerry. And yet, as you say, they may not have gotten the news in Iowa that he's supposed to be out of it. Joan Vinaki, here you are looking across the border and at New Hampshire, and you've been watching John Kerry for a long time. We've all seen him standing at the last debate in Des Moines, standing next to miniature Dennis Kucinich, towering John Kerry, that famous kind of patrician demeanor that may or may not connect with people. What do you see in this man? You said that he's now not making his opening stand in New Hampshire, but his last stand in New Hampshire, he's really depending on it now. How's it working out for the Massachusetts senator?
Well, Tom, I've been working the phones very hard today in Boston, and I'd say that the word on the street is expectations, which is sort of what Walter is reporting on live from Iowa. How much is Howard Dean going to win by? How much can somebody come in behind that? And there was a really interesting thing in the New York Times today talking about Kerry. Is it a real bounce or what they called a dead cat's bounce? So, I mean, that's, you know, really what's happening. In terms of New Hampshire, if what you said leading into the show is true, that polls are showing Wes Clark tied for second in New Hampshire with John Kerry.
And there I'm citing an American Research Group poll just out. It's got Howard Dean at 39% or 37% as of January 3rd to the 5th. Kerry at 14% and Clark at 14%.
If that's true, that's not good news for John Kerry. He needs Iowa. He needs Iowans to take a really good second look at him and not see a tall patrician.
But these are New Hampshire numbers with Wes Clark tied with John Kerry.
Right. But in order to reverse that, he needs something really positive to happen in Iowa to, I think, change the dynamic of what's shaking down in New Hampshire right now.
Jack Beatty, to take us into this man's biography a little bit and his politics and how they have combined to shape the guy that we see at the podium today.
Sure. I've been watching him really since 1972 when I attended a rally for his congressional campaign and Eugene McCarthy spoke for him. And he was then a luminous figure. I mean, he had testified before Congress as a leader of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He had said memorably, "How do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?" He had appeared on the Dick Cavett Show. He was eloquent, and you looked at him and you thought, this man is someday going to be president. And if I were to frame his life, I'd do it in terms of three C's. He's cultured, courageous, and complicated. Cultured. I mean, his family, the aristocratic Forbes Clippership family, that's the mother's side. They weren't the richest part of the family. Mm-hmm. But from his father's side, for years in Massachusetts, people thought he was Irish. He's named for one of the counties of Ireland. Well, in fact, it turns out it's an Austrian Jewish family. So he's got that strain in him. He's got European.
Which he himself said he learned very late on in his life. It was kind of obscured in the mist of time.
That's right. That's right. And his father was in the Foreign Service. He traveled a good deal. He was educated some abroad at St. Paul's and at Yale. And he one of his problems on the stump is that he knows so much. His he can go on forever. Teresa Heintz His wife said that she was charmed when at a meeting in Brazil, he started to sing a song in Portuguese at some sort of ceremony.
Wife, the widow of Senator John Heinz, with the ketchup fortune.
That's right. Courageous. I mean, this man won a Bronze Star in Vietnam for saving somebody's life, a Silver Star for exceptional courage under fire. He showed tremendous courage as a leader of the anti-war movement, being, of course, called all sorts of things by the Nixon White House. He stood up against the Iran-Contra affair. He took on Democratic poobah Clark Clifford, who in the BCCI investigation. There was no profit in that for him. And he's complicated, you know. Brahmin, European Jew, anti-war, pro-hero, and politically complicated. He's had to live in the shadows of this liberal icon, Ted Kennedy, who also was the most effective legislator of modern times, and he's had to try to nuance his way. I mean, he's been a little more conservative on some things, he's just had a very hard time navigating and working out a political persona. But altogether, he's among one of the most interesting people, I think, in American public life, partly because of all this complexity and the strains that are in him.
Walter Shapiro, I wonder how that complexity plays from what you've seen in middle America, in Iowa, and the big swath up the middle of the country.
Well, first of all, I totally agree with Jack. I find Kerry probably psychologically the most complicated and the most intriguing of any of the Democrats running. And sometimes the complications and the intellectual side overcome things. I saw him about 3 weeks ago talking at a breakfast in a house in Des Moines. And he started out of nowhere quoting T.S. Eliot's rather mournful, "We measure out our lives in coffee spoons." This is not normally a staple of political oratory.
No.
At the same point, what Kerry does appeal to is sort of the upper middle class, solid party activists in Iowa, the non-body piercing wing of the Democratic Party, if you will. And to some extent, they're attracted to the resume. Kerry can give a good speech. He can also go on forever. And there is no consistency in his performances. Yet, there you could still see him as the presidential nominee. He looks like a president, probably more than anyone running. But his real problem, going back to that complexity, is he does not exude happiness. No one is ever going to introduce John Kerry by saying, I give you the happy warrior of the political battlefield. And that may be ultimately his real problem.
Yeah, you know, and you could see that in the Des Moines debate over the weekend. There he was, all that craggy patrician kind of profile, but looking almost mournful somehow. Joan Vernacki, you've watched this man's character over time. What's striking you in the way it's unfolded in this campaign, which should be the sort of crowning campaign of a very long political career?
Well, I would say that I think the nuance and the complications that both Jack and Walter are talking about are definitely a part of who, you know, John Kerry is. I mean, that is his essence. But being complicated and quoting T.S. Eliot, you know, those are good ways to woo a woman. They're not necessarily a good way, I think, to woo, you know, voters in Iowa or New Hampshire or, you know, elsewhere in the country. Listening to that interview that you just did with him on the radio, you said, and I think correctly, he gives a very good radio interview when you're not looking at that mournful visage and you're just hearing he sharpened his mm-hmm. message. He's mm-hmm. got more direct answers than he used to have. And if he's doing that now in Iowa, again, I mean, I think that he does have a chance to exceed expectations and have people take a second look at him and do better than people think and, you know, come back with some sort of real bounce into New Hampshire.
Joan, Walter, Jack, a lot of callers want to join us. I want to invite them in. David is calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yes. I was a supporter of John Kerry from 1970 on. I thought he was one of the very – there was a lot of vets coming back
But he was as high profile as they came.
Yeah, right. And I supported him through his senatorial campaigns against Weld, I believe, and there was the person who was the head of the Republican Party in Massachusetts, I'm forgetting his name, who he ran against, and I actually worked for him in that campaign. But when he chose to vote to enable Bush to go to war in the way he did, myself and many, many people I know called his campaign and let him know, called his office in Washington and his office in Massachusetts, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and let him know that this was a very big mistake. One time my wife and I were standing at a rotary with a large banner which says war is not the answer, and the cars were honking like crazy in support. And I said, listen to what your constituents are saying. And if he went ahead with this, he was going to lose our support. And
but David, you heard his explanation again tonight, and I'm sure you've heard it before. He said, look, I made that vote with clear preconditions and clear stipulations, and here's what I expected of George Bush. Does any of that mean anything to you?
I don't believe he was that naive. I think he was making a political calculation that went wrong.
And so after that, you can't be turned around. You've walked away from the John Kerry bandwagon.
No, we were serious. And a lot of other people as well.
Against the war in a minute. David, thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, what about that? I mean, here you've got this irony. John Kerry voted against the war in 91, voted for the authorization in 2002, and then, of course, against the $87 billion Bush asked to back it up.
I know, and I think our caller speaks for so many other people who were so disappointed in that vote. You know, 20-odd Democrats did not vote for the war, and Senator Byrd made it very clear at the time. He said, those of you who are voting for this resolution are voting for war. Let's have no mistake about that. He mentioned the non-Biden, the Lugar-Biden resolution. Well, that would have said, you have to go to the UN first and then come back to us.
Mm-hmm.
He could have voted for that and not for the war, but he didn't. He voted for both. And when you look at it, you know, 1991, let's look at it. A clear provocation, an invasion. The whole world was with us. The whole world was going to pay for it. The Arab governments were involved. 2003, no one involved. We were going to pay for it. The Arab governments wanted no part of it, and there was no provocation. How do you explain it other than that It was a political calculation. He wanted to run for president in 1992. He was positioning himself. He was taking more conservative positions, getting ready for that. And then he voted wrong, as people thought, on the war, and with many other Democrats that year, couldn't run for that reason. Mm-hmm. And I think he and Dick Gephardt, in the same position, said, by God, we're not going to make that mistake again. And you know, what's so awful about it is what his experience was in Vietnam. Let me just quote from one of his war notes. This is what he wrote home. It is when one of your men got hit, or when you got hit yourself, that you felt most absurd. That was when everything had to have a meaning in order for it all to be worthwhile. And Vietnam just didn't have meaning. It didn't meet the test. When a good friend was hit and perhaps about to die, you'd ask if it was worth just his life alone, let alone all the other lives. A man who wrote that, voting for this war?
Walter Shapiro, in Des Moines, does John Kerry's explanation sell for why he made the vote, or do voters even, do they care? Are the caucus cockatiers out there coming in and casting their caucus votes on the basis of the war vote?
Well, what is really striking is how in the last month there are so many fewer backward-looking questions at public events about Iraq. That said, for my book, One Car Caravan, I spent a lot of time with Kerry both before and after the Senate vote at the end of 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while I have never, you know, and the Kerry's problem is that he never could answer the question back in those days explaining his vote in less than 6.5 minutes. And there was a defensible position. Yes, we should get rid of Saddam, but what's the hurry? Why not do it with allies? Why not do it through the UN? But there is also a level, going back to what Jack was saying, that in his speech and the torturous reasoning for his speech on the floor of the Senate, which was basically an anti-war speech, Kerry was in essence saying, like Humpty Dumpty, the votes I cast mean precisely what I say they do, nothing more or nothing less. Mm-hmm. But clearly, Kerry's vote in favor of the war has not been perceived the way he wanted it to be perceived. And to some extent, one other factual thing about Kerry and the war, I think, and I'm guessing here, I think one of the things that motivated him to vote for the war, is that he was the co-sponsor of the 1998 very anti-Saddam resolution that Bill Clinton pushed through the Senate.
And so he had a stake here.
So trying to maintain some level of consistency in an inconsistent background was even made harder by the 1998 vote.
Joan Vernacki, do you see Senator Kerry talking his way out of that vote bag with Democratic Party primary voters?
I think it's still a problem for him. Listen, just the other day when he took another endorsement from Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul and Mary.
Right.
Here's someone who's standing up to say, I support John Kerry, and has to be kind of carted off the stage saying, but I disagree with him on his vote for the war.
Mm-hmm.
And as Jack said so eloquently, John Kerry's past eloquence on the issue of war has come back to haunt him now. But on the other hand, the capture of Saddam Hussein has taken a little spark, I think, out of the whole anti-war thing behind Howard Dean.
It may not be as front and center as it once was.
It does put the focus back on pocketbook issues.
We're talking tonight with and about Senator John Kerry and his long, hard march on the White House. I'm joined by Walter Shapiro, author of One Car Caravan, Joan Vernacki with the Boston Globe, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join us as well. Kerry supporters, make your case. What puts you in Kerry's corner? And why is this Vietnam vet and 18-year senator not doing better in the polls? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking tonight with and about Senator John Kerry and his long, hard march on the White House. My guest tonight, Walter Shapiro, political columnist for USA Today and author of One Car Caravan, on the road with the 2004 Democrats before America tunes in. Joan Vernacki, Boston Globe op-ed columnist with me here in the studio tonight and in New Hampshire, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well. Two New England blue bloods, Kerry and Dean. Why is Dean ahead? John Kerry was a Vietnam War hero and a war protest hero. How do you read the complexity of this man? Is there a Shakespearean tale to be told in John Kerry? What is it? Is he a winner in waiting? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Janice is calling from Hull, Massachusetts. Hi, Janice. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree with so many things that people have said. I met Kerry very briefly a couple of years ago when Hillary Clinton went to Quincy, and I liked him very much. And I am very disappointed. Well, I was disappointed in the war vote, but I'm also disappointed that his message is not as cohesive and solid and as it might be, and I wonder how that could happen. And the other thing I wanted to say was that Bush has been very successful, despite the fact that he is a complete elite, at making the American people think that he's one of them. And Kerry has a harder time doing that.
Somehow he just doesn't do the twang and a bow-legged thing just as easily, does he?
Well, first of all, he is an intellectual, and I'm afraid that the man in the White House is not.
But Janice, for all that, does John Kerry have your vote if it comes to it?
He does, and I wanted to just bring up one point that I'd love some discussion on, and I don't know if it's a correlation, but I doubt it, because I really think that people are primates and vote more unconsciously than they think. But I wonder if people are aware that in every single election since Washington, the taller of the two candidates has won.
Well, I haven't kept the record, but we'll take your question up, Janice, and thanks for your call. Joan Vinaki, first to this issue of Kerry and cohesive message. You've written recently that you're quoting Tom O'Neill, Tip O'Neill's son, Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House's son, saying all he has to do is give people a reason to vote for him. You wrote, it sounds so simple, but Kerry has yet to do it and time is growing short. This is a very well-spoken man. He's got a lot of experience. He's got pretty set views of the world. Is there a problem with communicating that vision, and if so, why?
Well, I think up until recently, the problem was really the problem that comes with spending much of your life in Washington as a legislator, where, you know, victory is what you can get in the middle. It's not the edges. And he's always, you know, that day that I watched him in New Hampshire, he was always talking about the proposal that he had, or, you know, it was all about paper and documents and very bureaucratic language. Mm-hmm. From the sounds of it now, he's kind of honed his message. He's talking more of a populist talk, which is what Democrats do when they're losing in the polls. Gore did it. Dukakis did it way back in 1988. It can be effective, but I guess the question is it too little too late for him?
Mm-hmm. And Walter Shapiro, what about the issue that Janice raises? John Kerry is not the only well-heeled Northeasterner in this race. You could put George Bush in that category to some extent. John Dean certainly fits in it. Why does it seem to stick to Kerry more?
I've often thought that Howard Dean has the family tree that everyone imagines John Kerry with two generations of Eastern European Jews converted to Catholicism behind him has. That said, about a month ago in Iowa, I saw Kerry and Dean back to back, and they both were making the same point. Dean was talking about how dangerous it is. We have loose nukes in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and the Bush administration isn't paying for the program to get rid of them. Kerry was denouncing the president's failure to fund the Nunn-Lugar Act.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that danger of talking Washingtonese that's one of the differences. But I will say, and I think it's – I cannot live with myself if I get through this hour without mentioning it. John Kerry did something quite courageous in today's debate on NPR.
Mm-hmm.
He defended the traditional view – that a candidate's religious beliefs have no bearing on his public life. At a point when Howard Dean is announcing that he is going to go south and talk about Jesus.
He's coming to Jesus south of the Mason-Dixon.
The notion that there is a separation between church and state, between pulpit and politics, is an honorable tradition in America. And I thought it was very telling that when asked about that, John Kerry didn't pander, didn't do the politically easy thing, but really upheld that tradition.
And Jack Beatty, he is the tall guy out there. Is there a scenario that you can imagine that somehow, as people get really serious coming into the home stretch, John Kerry's experience, his war record, and all the rest somehow fall in behind him in a way that pushes him ahead of where people are right now expecting?
Well, it certainly could happen. But on the tall guy thing, you know, Al Gore was, in fact, taller than the 5'11" George Bush.
So, quite right.
I understand Janice is probably right about everybody else. But you know, I mean, I really think if you look at the polls, I mean, Walter would know this better than I do. I mean, Kerry's problems came when the occupation came to Iraq, just when George Bush's problems came in the polls. And then in September, when Dean was maybe marginally ahead, along comes Wesley Clark. And he has really stolen John Kerry's thunder because he can say, I can debate Bush on foreign policy and national security better than Kerry.
You don't need a Vietnam War hero. I was doing it a couple of years ago.
That's right. And I had the right position on the war, although that's much more equivocal than it may seem. So I think he's picked up a lot of that Kerry possibility. And I think that his being tied with Kerry in New Hampshire, those are votes that are coming out of Kerry.
Dane is calling from Onalaska, Wisconsin. Hi, Dane. You're on the air.
Hello. I want to just make the same comment that I more or less did to a DNC fundraiser that called me this last weekend.
Okay.
We have Howard Dean leading the pack, and we have all these other people sniping at him, including Senator Kerry and so forth. And once again, it's leading to seemingly a fractured party, a.k.a. Ross Perot 92, where once again the Democrats can't put up a unified front the way the Republicans did, say, in 2000. Therefore, they're asking me for money, and I think I'm putting it towards a losing cause. I suggested if they could get some of these people out, my druthers would have Dennis Kucinich's. And but practicality dictates that's just not going to happen.
So what are you suggesting, Dane, that all these candidates, after everything they've poured into it, just shut up and sit down and give it to Howard Dean?
That they should come to some sort of realization, realize they're leading a party as opposed to trying to get themselves elected and try and put up that unified front that would appeal to the likes of me and maybe even some of the liberals that might even come back to the Democratic Party to beat George Bush.
Yeah, I hear you. Walter Shapiro, can you see a scenario like that where a great party holding of hands suddenly takes hold here and people agree to kind of step back and let one come to the fore? Or is this going to be, people are mortgaging their homes. John Kerry's got quite a fine one on Beacon Hill, and it's going to the, you know, back to the mortgage shop. That's not for nothing, presumably. Are we going to fight this to the last dog dies?
I think we're going to fight this for a while as long as there is a viable candidate against Dean, as long as there's the opening slot for the anti-Dean candidate. And I think the caller is wrong. I don't think voters expect a political party to offer a coherent alternative 10 months before the general election. At this point in 2000, the Republican Party with an insurgent John McCain was not exactly a unity breakfast. They were not practicing Brotherhood Week. And the fact is the Democrats are so united in their willingness, in their passion to get George W. Bush out of the White House, that so far I don't see any fissures in the Democratic Party from this contest that couldn't be healed by one rueful press conference and about 3 days of sort of thinking it over.
And John Vinaki, we all see them, you know, sniping and biting on Howard Dean, but we don't really see chunks of flesh coming off here. He's still standing there.
Well, they call him the Teflon candidate or Godzilla, and with good reason. And, I mean, I don't want to disagree with Walter because he's the expert and he's on the ground and all that. But I think at some point people will have to ask themselves, when does demonizing Dean become aiding and abetting the Republican Party? And when is it just drawing distinctions between you and an opponent?
Why is it different than Bush McCain 4 years ago, Joan?
Well, there was blood. I mean, there was a pretty brutal fight between them. But then at a set point after South Carolina, I think McCain, you know, put aside his differences and it was all unity. I mean, I think you can fight up to a point. The question is, how far will it go? Also, the point about Wes Clark, I think he's clearly the beneficiary of John Kerry's attacks. As people have said earlier, he's got the military record. His ads on television, I think, are very effective. They're very positive. When you first hear them and see them, you almost think they're John Kerry ads because of the Vietnam thing.
Right.
But they're all positive, and you don't hear Wes Clark going after Dean the same way that you hear John Kerry.
So he lets John Kerry do the attack work and then comes in behind.
His fundraising was very impressive in the last quarter. He could come out of New Hampshire with, a second-place win and money to fight in the South.
And yet I guess it's hard for John Kerry. If he's in the race and he's in Iowa, he can hardly stand on the podium and say nothing about the front runner, about the man who's so far at this moment in the lead. Annie's calling from Amherst, New Hampshire. Hi, Annie. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
My comment was really about the fact that I'm kind of overexposed in some ways to what's going on because I live in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And what I've been disappointed about with Kerry is that I have a tremendous amount of respect for him, but it's very difficult to understand what he's standing for. And without that, what I'm left with is his presence and his image. And the way he appears is as a man who is old and tired, almost lethargic. You don't feel any sense of energy or someone who could win this race.
Boy, I mean, I've seen that sometimes on television. I guess in the debate today, I could hear some weariness in the voices of many of the candidates there. But I have to say, speaking with him earlier in the hour on the radio, I guess he was in his bus on the way to Cedar Rapids, he sounded pretty perky. Is it the power of that face with all the lines of political battles in it that you're responding to, Annie?
I think that somehow affects it, especially when you juxtapose that against the George Bush and the image that he projects. And so I think it is hindering his ability to actually project, the fact that he, is really has the energy and the drive to do what it's going to take to beat George Bush.
Annie, got it, and thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, what do you make of that? Is this where we get down to the Shakespearean bit? He's sort of earned that face in a lot of battles, real and political, and now Annie calls up and says, boy, it looks like he's been through the mill. He doesn't have the pop.
Well, I think she's really caught something, and the connection she made between the lack of a very clear program, the question that Janice raised, you then look at his persona, and you do see that this man who seems like the knight of woeful countenance. And, when he came back from Vietnam, there were nightmares, there were rages, and in his letters, he tells stories that just make you cry. I mean, he talked about his ship his boat shot at a sampan. And he went over, and there was a small lump of a small child dead. And the mother had already covered it, he wrote. And when one of the men asked me if I wanted it uncovered, I said no, realizing that face would stay with me for the rest of my life, and that it was better not to know whether there was a smile or a grimace or whether it was a boy or a girl. You've got that on your mind. You're not a happy person.
Joan, when John Kerry is playing to the electorate, in his own mind, who's he playing to?
Who is he playing to?
Yeah,
besides the face in the mirror?
Well, yes, besides that.
Well, I'm not sure the answer to that question, but I was just thinking, listening to you and Jack and the caller, that perhaps, like if Abe Lincoln were running in 2004, he might not be electable. I mean, we're so into face and lines and visage and image in a way, through the whole medium of television now, that it clearly shapes a lot of the way we feel about candidates. And I just, wonder, this last year has been taking a tough toll on him. He's had a sickness. He's had an illness. He's got to be tired. But I don't find him as
surgery earlier.
Right. He doesn't seem that old and drawn to me. I mean, he seems pretty vigorous to me. I'll give him that much.
And Walter Shapiro,
he's a fighter. He's fighting.
He is a fighter, and he's proven that before. And out in Iowa, you say, Walter, we just got a few seconds left here, but you see the signs of that fight. You see the perk.
There is a sense that there is a resurgence to Kerry here. I don't know how far it's going to carry him, but I am the last person to write any serious candidate out of this Democratic race, especially before no votes have been cast.
And there's no question this is a serious candidate in Senator John Kerry. Walter Shapiro, wonderful to have you tonight. Thanks so much
it's
for joining
fun.
Us.
It's been fun.
Walter Shapiro, political columnist for USA Today and author of One Car Caravan. And Joan Vinaki, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack, thanks for being with us from New Hampshire.
Thank you.
Listeners, to hear our interviews with other Democratic candidates like Howard Dean, Joe Lieberman, Dick Gephardt, and others, go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.